I'm Steve Punt.
And I'm Hugh Dennis.
With us are Ahir Shah, Jess Robinson, Gemma Arrowsmith and Marcus Brigstock. And this is...
The Now Show!
Thank you very much. I say. Why is the EU Brexit transition offer like someone trying to get hold of your online data?
I don't know. Why is the EU Brexit transition offer like someone trying to get hold of your online data?
Because they both involve phishing scams. There's more where that came from. You'll be delighted to learn. Also, in both cases, they are good examples of the old saying, if something looks too good to be true, it probably is. Leaving the EU will be simple and cost nothing? Turns out, probably not. All those free services the internet will give us for nothing? Turns out, from this week's Facebook shenanigans, that we were paying in data. Reams of information about ourselves we willingly handed over, sometimes without even bothering to set up the security filter. And there's a new saying to remember. In the past...
careless talk costs lives.
Now...
careless settings... cause Trump. Advertisers and marketers have been after our information for decades, but now we do so much online, they have an unprecedented amount of it, and political campaigners found ways to get hold of it, because they've always tried to analyse us too.
Yeah, you remember all those ways they've tried to categorise people? Essex man, Worcester woman, soccer moms. You may remember the 1997 election revolved heavily around trying to appeal to Mondeo man. Very much Marvel's least successful superhero. But now, thanks to the internet, we don't need to target vague social groups. We can target actual individuals via their online data, what they search, what they like, what they click, what they read. And aggregating this data is the job of companies like the now notorious Cambridge Analytica. Now, what bothers me about them is that Analytica isn't a word. But A is right next to S on a keyboard. And I can't help wondering if they were actually called Cambridge Analytics... but nobody proofread their letterhead. Because analytics is a word, whereas Cambridge Analytica sounds like a Ryman League football team. But the fact is, what they do and how they do it is very complex and technical and frankly rather confusing. All across the country, there are confused people having conversations.
So Cambridge Analytica are denying using data from Facebook.
Yeah, but if they're Russian, why are they from Cambridge?
No, Russia may have helped Cambridge Analytica, who are funded by an American.
Right, so then the Russians voted for Brexit?
No, Russians voted for Putin, but Putin wanted to vote for Brexit to split Europe.
Well, how did that help Trump?
Because they were using the data from Facebook.
Oh, so Facebook was taking data from Russia?
No, not Facebook. Someone was giving data to Cambridge Analytica.
What, the football team?
And they were helping Trump.
Except they were actually helping the people helping Trump, because Trump doesn't use a computer, he's never sent an email, probably thinks Cambridge Analytica is a porn star, he once dated.
So I'm confused now. Are you saying Russian Facebook helped Brexit?
No.
Are you saying Jeremy Corbyn's hat was photoshopped by Cambridge Analytica?
No, I'm just saying that when you filled in that Facebook quiz about which Muppet you are, you were inadvertently subverting democracy.
Fragmenting the post-war Western alliance.
Well, I only went on Facebook to try and find out if my ex had got a new boyfriend yet.
And had she?
Yes. And I think he's Russian.
It's because data analysis is so technical that most of the media have concentrated on Facebook, because we all understand what that is. The main question seems to be who knew what and when about how the information would be used. Mark Zuckerberg has admitted mistakes were made and changed his ethical status to "it's complicated."
But even if they can access all this information about us, does any of it actually do any good?
Because the profiling that comes out of online data is often suspect. Judging by the targeted ads I'm sent, the internet has me down as a man who's only interested in military history, comfortable shoes and power tools. And that is clearly wrong, isn't it? I am also interested in wheelbarrows. But let me tell you what happens when you buy a wheelbarrow.
Yes?
The next ad that comes up is for wheelbarrows.
Yes, it's clever, isn't it?
No, I've just bought a wheelbarrow. Which means literally the last thing I want to be inundated by is ads for wheelbarrows. Because get this, internet, I have just bought a wheelbarrow. And I won't be buying another one for 10 years, assuming the design is sturdy enough. The axle's the key thing, because if that breaks, they can roll anywhere. Which makes an ad for a wheelbarrow the last thing I want to see. Of all the ads you could have sent me from all the things that are available on the internet, it is literally the thing I'm least in need of and the ad I am least likely to act on, especially the ones that have a ball instead of a wheel.
Next on Gardener's Question Time. What's frightening, though, is the accuracy that they can now achieve, because they can get so many of what they call data points, up to 80, apparently, and you don't need many to start building a profile of someone. Sometimes you only need one. If you've ever filled in a marketing survey, for example, you will know that they always ask,
what newspaper do you read?
And that's because that one single data point is considered very revealing. If I say someone is
Guardian reader,
you instantly have a completely different picture in your head to if I say Sun reader, and different again to if I say Telegraph reader. A whole series of associations and assumptions are made from that one data point. And that's why an ad in The Sun will say,
have you suffered an industrial accident? Work with asbestos. We can help you claim compensation.
Whereas one in The Telegraph will say,
have you sustained a gardening injury? Have you run over your foot with one of those wheelbarrows with a ball instead of a wheel? You may be entitled to concomitant recompense.
One thing we do know is that it's almost impossible to erase online data, even when you're dead. In fact, the list of things you can still do once you're dead is quite short, but you can still have a Facebook account.
Yes, you can still be sent tax demands.
And you can still vote in a Russian election.
There is one advantage to all this, though. There's so much data to be destroyed now that shredding could become an Olympic demonstration sport.
Well, that's Mark Zuckerberg of the USA single-handedly destroying 1.2 terabytes in a world record time. Back to you, Hazel.
Thanks, and we're going over to the ultra-modern pentathlon, in which a computer hard drive is shot, dropped into a swimming pool, jumped on by a horse, cut in half with a fencing sword, and finally run 1,500 metres attached to the bottom of someone's shoe. And one result just in, the Russians have just taken the gold medal in the 4x400 sheets of A4 relay, where they successfully shredded 10 years' worth of urine test results in just 9.2 seconds. And now back to see the British pair of Farage and Rees-Mogg in the one we've been waiting for. Throwing the haddock.
Now, our next guest used to appear on the Now Show every week, but rather like a pensioner who's given up fruit and vegetables for Lent, he is slightly less regular these days. Please welcome back to the show, Marcus Brigstock.
Hello, divided, angry Britain. These are trying times. The recent survey showed the UK is more divided than at any time in our history. Impressive when you consider the thousands of lives lost in the Marmite Wars of the late 90s. We have alt-right versus loony left, Brextremists versus Ramonas, snowflakes versus actual Nazis. We have Jacob Rees-Mogg versus everything since 1852. Radio 4 listeners versus whatever those other weirdos and simpletons listen to. The most divided place in all of Britain, Theresa May. Just Theresa May on her own, a battlefield of torment, every morning sobbing into her bathroom mirror at the despairing, pale, haunted woman she sees gurning back at her, pleading,
make it stop! Dear God, Theresa, make it stop!
So in an age when it's hard to know who the baddies are, we need something to unify, jollify and simplify our troubled lives. And I think I've got the solution. I propose we ring up David Hasselhoff and see if he'd be willing to put back the Berlin Wall. He took it down. He can put it back. Look, I know it was a miserable time for lots of people and the Cold War was terrifying, but at least we knew which side to be on. And Elton John did that lovely song about Nikita. It was simpler. Bond villains were easy to identify. If James Bond met a Russian, then he or she was a baddie. And if it was a she, Bond was allowed to sex her into being a goodie. It was a simpler, different time.
So, it looks like the game's up, Svetlana.
For you, Mr. Bond, yes, I'm afraid it is.
How do you propose to kill me?
Slowly, Mr. Bond. Very slowly. By buying up all the overpriced property in London and making it impossible for key workers and young people to afford a home.
You are diabolical.
How dare you, Mr. Bond? I'll have you know I'm a major Conservative Party donor.
Obviously, those early Bond movies were very problematic for Jeremy Corbyn, who had absolutely no idea who to cheer for. Yeah, a 70s Bond movie for Jeremy Corbyn is like me watching Jeremy Clarkson interviewing David Starkey. I sort of want them both lasered in the plums. And, of course, because Corbyn obsessives are such a fun-loving, humourful bunch of sweethearts, I'll get more flack online for that daft observation than if I'd gone down to the RSC and flung an actual human poo at Judi Dench. See, this is what I mean, division and conflict, and I'm to blame. I know. I bellow into my own digital media echo chamber and I hear mostly what I want in reply. Every day I go online and say, isn't Brexit awful? And I hear, yes, you're right, Marcus. Brexit is a terrible, terrible idea. Dangerous, myopic, reckless, dishonest and stupid. It's based on lies and will have its worst effect on those who are already vulnerable and deprived. All right, echo chamber, take it easy. Actually, I really hope that a UKIP voter tuned in by mistake at exactly that moment. And went, aha! I knew that's what the BBC really thought. Actually, there was a UKIP complaint about bias at the BBC this week from disgraced liar and cheat Neil Hamilton, who described some children interviewed on The World at One as mawkish, and complained that none of the answers given by the nine-year-olds were challenged by the presenter for being childish. I mean, he's not wrong, is he? Don't you just hate it when children are children? But at least Neil Hamilton is a proper identifiable baddie, and for that we must thank him. How he had a musical written about him, I will never know. I don't like the lack of trust and constant division we have now, and I know I'm responsible for it. We all are. We're all the baddies. Too busy with our own importance to change our own behaviour. I'm embarrassed to say this, but it's true. I have almost certainly killed a dolphin through my use of plastic straws. I know. It took ages. And nearly a whole box of plastic straws. In the end, I had to drive one into its blowhole and inflate it. No, you're right. I do regret it. And I'm banned from SeaWorld. So. In a recent survey carried out as part of the Edelman Trust and Credibility Survey, people were asked if they were fearful that fake news was now being used as a weapon. And a staggering 11 out of 10 people said yes. The reality is, in fact, that 7 in 10 people are concerned that fake news is being used as a weapon. The other three, who said they weren't concerned, turned out all to be Russian Twitter bots answering under the entirely plausible name of Chuck Patriot Stars and Stripeson. Interestingly, social media has hit an all-time low with fewer than 25% of respondents saying they trusted it for news and information. And that was before Facebook was exposed as being about as trustworthy as a lion volunteering to babysit a tethered gazelle covered in gravy. Well, I'm out of time, and if you want to know what I really think, you'll find me on social media trying to persuade David Hasselhoff into chanting Build That Wall at Angela Merkel. Thank you.
Marcus Brigstock. So, with the NHS pay deal on the table this week, we thought we'd better talk to someone about it.
So, please welcome the author of the Sunday Times bestseller, This Is Going to Hurt, Secret Diaries of a Junior Doctor, Adam Kay.
So, you wrote your book, didn't you, partially as a response to the junior doctor's strike. And we've had this announcement of a pay increase in the NHS. So do you feel positive about that? Is it going to make a difference?
Ish. So it's a 6.5% pay rise for most of the rank and file over 3 years. So that's 2 and a bit percent a year. And inflation's more than that. So it is actually a pay cut in real terms. But it's better than a 0% rather than 6.5%. So, I mean, they've started to turn the tap on, but the plug's still out the bath.
And is the general malaise isn't really about money? Is it about hours, for example?
It's about hours in part. The hours have always been tough. Looking back through my diaries, I worked oftentimes 97 hours a week. Over the 7 years I worked as a doctor, I saw my family for one Christmas, so it wasn't all bad. Something a lot of people don't realise about junior doctors is that you move hospital once a year. So the country's divided up into what are called deaneries, and you're bounced around within that deanery. So you work at bigger hospitals and smaller hospitals and so on, which would make sense, but the deaneries are quite big. For example, one of them's called Scotland. And it's very inconvenient to buy a flat that's handy for all of Scotland.
So, clearly, you know, you saw some awful things working as a doctor. So was writing the book a kind of therapy? I mean, does humour play a part?
It does. So I worked in the field of obstetrics and gynaecology, or parts and labour, as it was known. And you end up with twice the number of patients you start with, which is... which is a pretty good batting average for any specialty of medicine. But the height of the highs is set off by the depth of the lows, so you do end up looking for these shards of light amongst... the dark as a coping mechanism. And so I would write down any of the sort of funny stuff that happened to me. Here was one of the earliest ones from 2005. After a lengthy discussion with a patient's husband about how absolutely no condoms fit him, I establish he's pulling them right down over his balls.
Well, let me just check. You're saying that's wrong, right?
So if it's such a hard profession, why do people become doctors?
It's the most wonderful profession in the world, it really is. And it's a huge privilege to play that part in people's lives. But you make that decision actually when you're 16, when you're choosing your A-level subjects that the medical schools demand. And 16 is a very bad age to decide to do anything, really, isn't it? And so it's generally because, your parents are doctors or you quite like Holby or something like that. And... there's no test of emotional resilience, really. So if you were to go on a training program to be an astronaut or even a train driver, even to go on Big Brother, they would check that you were sort of emotionally robust for it. But in medicine, they just check you've got your exam results and that you've got extracurricular activities. So they want you to have, you grade at oboe and be captain of the first 11, the first 15, or be good at lacrosse. And if you look at the CV, Wikipedia entry of any famous doctor through history, it's been the same. So... here's one. He proved himself an accomplished rugby player in youth leagues. He excelled as a distance runner and in his final year at school was vice captain of the athletics team. And that's Harold Shipman, so it's potentially not a completely rock solid system.
But having become aware of your book, you were invited to a meeting with Jeremy Hunt. Yeah? Good meeting?
That was... so basically what had happened... is people kept at book signings and things asking for a second copy to be signed to Jeremy Hunt, and they would post them off. And eventually I got this note through via the publishers saying, "Dear Adam, if you come and meet me, will people stop sending me this bloody book? Love, Jeremy Hunt." And so I did go and meet him, and it was quite a thorny meeting, really. I had lots of questions I wanted to ask him, and he was being very brittle and short with me, and it got a bit tense. I think he wanted a nice chat, and I wanted to hold him to task slightly for some of the terrible decisions he's made. My views, not those of the BBC. and then at the end, I felt really bad, because, no one likes having that sort of air in a room, and so I said, "I'm sorry if I came across nicer on paper than I do in real life." And he said, "Oh, no, I think you've been quite consistent."
So, basically, the NHS's loss has been comedy's gain. So thank you very much, Adam Kay.
Thank you. Thank you.
And now, on The Now Show, a comic who once said that the funniest book he'd ever read was written by Friedrich Nietzsche. So here's hoping he brings us the same laugh riot as the old Apollonian versus Dissiac dichotomy. It's Ahir Shah.
Hello. My name is Ahir Shah, 27 years old. It's a difficult time to be a young person, Living in London, a city consistently dragging itself up by its cranes to ever new heights of unaffordability, now only really accessible as a playground for the super rich and their offspring. I'm not from that sort of background myself, regardless of what you may think from the way that I pronounce the word years. The reason that I sound like this is when my grandparents came to the UK in the 1960s, my grandfather told his three children, including my mother, that in the interests of integration, whenever they were outside of the house, they were banned from speaking to one another in Gujarati, their mother tongue, and instead had to speak in sort of prim and proper and at the time affected received pronunciation accents in order to minimize the chances of them getting the shit kicked out of them, right? Now, I once asked my uncle if this tactic worked, and he just looked at me and went, "Heavens no!" So those previous generations, they achieved so much more despite starting out with so much less, My granddad turned up here on his own with £3 in his back pocket, and he was able to build a family, build a life for them over here. He was able to own property, right, largely because he drove down house prices in every neighbourhood he went to, but he was able to... How times have changed. A half century on, I live in a house share in Brixton, South London. My rent is £700 a month. I live next to a prison. Not even like a good prison, like a fine prison. The prisoners are nearer to the tube station than I am. If I killed someone, I'd have a swifter commute. I wouldn't be able to take advantage of it. Wouldn't have to pay rent either. Finally stick to a regular gym schedule. Brixton, as an area, it's experiencing a lot of gentrification, you know? I've gentrified places in the past, certainly. I remember living in Streatham, South London, for a year, and towards the end of my tenancy, I walked to the train station and saw that the minicab office had turned into an artisanal bakery, and I was like, my work here is done. To me, gentrification has always been a sort of euphemism for the processes by which the market prices white children out of their parents' racism. Do you know what I mean? I know Papa said they were dangerous, Olivia, but there's nowhere else left. Think of the housing market problem. As with a lot of stuff in the economy, is in large part due to the massive intergenerational divide that we've got going on in this country, you know? Social, political, economic power still largely bound up with the older generation, right? Baby boomers. A generation at the top who are using their lofty position in order to sort of like pull the ladder up from after them and then sort of like set fire to the ladder, right? Destroy all ladder manuals, right? Systematically underfund every ladder factory in the country, retrospectively deny the existence of ladders while claiming that in their day they were simply better at jumping. I don't want you to think I'm being unfair to the older generation. I know who listens to Radio 4, and I don't want to be getting angry telegrams, right? But what are you probably at home listening to this thinking, here, chill out, you know? I'm a baby boomer. We single-handedly destroyed an entire global ecosystem in one generation. The hell have you ever done? Right? Fair enough, swag. That was badass. Game, respect, game. I admire what you guys did with the hustle, right? But the problem is, with intergenerational inequality, it's like any kind of inequality, right? The deck is stacked, and we pretend it's a question of priorities that has prevented outcomes from being identical, right? The number of times I've heard, you're worried you'll never get on the housing ladder, but you're happy to spend £3 on one of your fancy coffees, aren't you? Yeah. Concerned you'll never even get a little flat, but you'll spend £3 on one of your fancy coffees. Bruv, that's because you bought all the £3 houses! Few of those left, I'd prioritise it over a macchiato, sure. That is not the world we currently live in. So now, it just feels as though we're being forced to live through some gross fetishized approximation of someone else's good old days. And it's standing in the way of constructing good new days that might turn into my good old days one day, you know? And good for who, anyway? When you get down to it, what's the principal difference between those largely fictitious good old days and the actual present day? Well, just so happens to be the presence of people who look like me. Broadly speaking, I like people who look like me. I know the newspapers call them stuff like scroungers and cockroaches. I've always just gone with mum and dad. So, I mean, it's just normal people like anyone else, really. It's not a cockroach or a scrounger. It's mum and dad, you know. Admittedly, my dad is unemployed and mum would survive a nuclear holocaust through sheer stubbornness, but that's just a gigantic coincidence. Thank you very much. Cheers, guys.
And here's Charlie. And now, would you please welcome back to the Now Show, musician and impressionist who's currently touring with her show, Here Come the Girls, it's Jess Robinson.
This week, director Danny Boyle revealed that not only will he be working on the new Bond film, but he also suggested the possibility of creating an updated, more emotionally complex Bond, a feminist spy who reflects the post-hashtag MeToo world. Imagine how it might have been if the prolific 007 franchise had always had a more respectful attitude towards women.
Nobody does it better. Makes me feel sad for the rest. I know you're looking right into my eyes, not checking out my breasts.
See me coming out of the ocean, a big sou'wester and anorak. No bikini, no slow motion. A girl with clothes on, go on, film that. Danny Boyle got a great solution. Pay men and women equally. Danny Boyle dragged this institution into the 21st century.
So instead of...
Ah, Miss Sanders, I didn't recognise you with your clothes on.
It would have been...
Ah, Miss Sanders, I was fascinated to read your advanced copy of your PhD thesis.
Instead of...
I approve of your uniform. Tight in all the right places, not too many buttons.
It would have been...
What a sensible choice of coat for the time of year.
And instead of...
Now put your clothes back on and I'll buy you an ice cream.
Just no!
Imagine if in Skyfall the women weren't all invisible, but something more than just a token. Cause if Doctor Who can, then maybe you can do it better. Make a Bond a new man who treats a woman like a human. That would be more blooming acceptable.
Jess Robinson, thank you for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to The Now Show, starring Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Marcus Brigstock, Ahir Shah, Jess Robinson, Gemma Arrowsmith and Adam Kay. It was written by the cast with additional material from Sarah Morgan, Ian Smith, Mike Shepherd and Bisha Ali. Musical arrangement was by Alex Silverman. The producer was Matt Strong. It was a BBC Studios production.